Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening and welcome. Thank you for tuning in to Voices of the Sacred Feminine, the extended edition. That was just a tiny little tease or a snippet from the group called Be Optimistic, and the song was called Maria. Tonight, our guest is Dr. Darnese Martin, and our topic is Sex and the Sacred Feminine, Casting Your Pearls Before Swine. And to quote our guest, the connection between sexuality and the sacred is often misunderstood or ignored altogether. Sexuality is often equated with the pornographic, not accepted for the powerful spiritual force that it is. Likewise, women have been marginalized and blamed within that worldview. Understanding the sacred feminine energy that women bring to the world helps correct such erroneous viewpoints and simultaneously empowers women who otherwise do not know how to appreciate or value themselves. So please stay tuned in. Now, if you're new to Voices of the Sacred Feminine here on Blog Talk, because we haven't been here at our new home that long, we can take your calls now and answer your questions. So if you like, dial in later on and ask questions toward the end of the interview. That number is on your computer screen, but I'll give it to you here, 718-766-4662. When I see your call on the switchboard, I'll identify you by your area code and welcome you to have a chance to ask our guest a question. And that number again is 718-766-4662. And remember, if you can't listen live or don't want to be on the air, you can always email me some of your questions in advance. But please keep tuning in each Wednesday night at 6. Don't miss us. In fact, if you join Blog Talk as a listener, you can have reminders sent to you right to your email box of our shows so you won't forget our awesome guests coming up each week. And please, if you're a fan of the show, please indicate that by selecting us as a favorite on Blog Talk Radio. Well, now it's time for our opening segment we call What's the Buzz? Today I want to applaud an article I came across on our Sacred Feminine Ideals e-list sent to me by Loretta Kemsley, who's a wonderful resource for me. She's just plugged in everywhere. She sent me an article from Baha'i.org, and the article's name is Two Wings of a Bird, The Equality of Women and Men. And it was a statement of the National Spiritual Assembly of the Baha'i Faith of the United States. I'm only going to read a few sentences here and there so you get the gist, then invite you to go to info@Baha'i.org for the entire article. So this is how it starts. The emancipation of women, the achievement of full equality between the sexes, is essential to human progress and the transformation of society. Inequality retards not only the advancement of women, but the progress of civilization itself. The persistent denial of equality to one half of the world's population is an affront to human dignity. It promotes destructive attitudes and habits in men and women that pass from the family to the workplace to political life and ultimately to international relations. On no grounds, moral, biological, or traditional, can inequality be justified. The moral and psychological climate necessary to enable our nation to establish social justice and to continue to global peace will be created only when women attain full partnership with men in all fields of endeavor. And it, there's more there, but a couple sentences that really jumped out at me I want to make sure I share with you. The full and equal participation of women in all spheres of life is essential to social and economic development, the abolition of war, and the ultimate establishment of a united world. Men have an inescapable duty to promote the equality of women. The presumption of superiority by men thwarts the ambition of women and inhibits the creation of an environment in which equality may reign. The destructive effects of inequality prevent men from maturing and developing the qualities necessary to meet the challenges of a new millennium. As long as women are prevented from attaining their highest possibilities, the Baha'i writing state, so long will men be unable to achieve the greatness which might be theirs. The long-standing and deeply rooted condition of inequality must be eliminated. To overcome such a condition requires the exercise of nothing short of genuine love, extreme patience, true humility, consummate tact, sound initiative, mature wisdom, and deliberate, persistent, and prayerful effort. Well, you might wonder why I consistently have articles such as these and What's the Buzz? Well, it's because the programming has been so pervasive that women are inferior to men. From the very beginning in the Garden of Eden, too many women and men have drank the Kool-Aid, and I hope these articles help us to remember the state of women everywhere and help as perhaps, I don't know, an antidote or inoculation against sexism or any of the insidious isms. Okay, the bees are released from my bonnet for another week. And now to our guest, Dr. Darnese Martin. Let me tell you a bit about her in case this is your first introduction to her. Darnese Martin has a PhD and is a spirituality and relationship mentor with 15 years of graduate education, training, and experience in helping people transform their lives. Dr. Darnese holds a doctorate in religious studies from the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. She's an assistant professor at Loyola Marymount University in L.A., where she teaches courses in African American studies and theological studies. She's the author of Beyond Christianity, African Americans and a New Thought Church, which was published by New York University Press. It's a unique work that links traditional religious teachings with the New Thought perspective. She's also the founder of the Quest for Meaning Institute, dedicated to teaching the practical application of spirituality to daily life. She speaks regularly to church and school communities, and she's been interviewed by television and radio show hosts such as Tavis Smiley for his NPR radio show. So I would imagine Dr. Darnese is available here in L.A. if your group needs a speaker. So welcome to the show, Dr. Martin.
Well, thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, I love the topic you submitted to me. Let's see, Sex and the Sacred Feminine, Casting Your Pearls Before Swine. I really think this is something so many of us women really need to think about and reflect on, because too often we do sort of sell ourselves short, I think, don't you?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And we don't necessarily even know where that's come from.
Well, where has it come from?
Wow, how far back should we go?
Well, shoot, we can go back to the Garden of Eden or the Bible. I know it goes back at least that far.
Yeah, I mean, you know, we could say for any particular woman at any particular time, you know, she sort of inherited from her family, her immediate family, her immediate society, which has its rules about what is appropriate female behavior. And then, you know, we can trace that back and say, okay, well, where, if a girl is learning that from her father and her brothers, where do they get it from? And so we can go on back and say, yeah, well, we definitely find it among some conservative branches of different religions. And so if we look, for example, at the trilogy of Judaism and Christianity and Islam, we can look to our own book of Genesis or our own Bible traditions and see that right off the bat, right, the woman is cast as someone who has basically undone civilization. I mean, we're told that Eve, you know, God created this great, you know, made this creation and all was well. They were told don't eat from the tree of knowledge, and yet, you know, she led Adam into it, and so she's a great seductress, and the weaker vessel is language that some conservatives use, the weaker vessel, which is why the snake or the Satan went to her, knowing that she's weaker, offered her, oh, don't worry about what God told you, eat this, it's great. And so we have this tradition right off the bat that says, well, see, women are weaker, they don't have the intellect to reason through things. And
there's so much wrong with that interpretation, though, you know.
Okay.
I mean, why wouldn't we want to, you know, take a bite from the tree of knowledge? Do we want to stay ignorant all of our lives? Or was the tree of knowledge, would that have brought us too close to God? What was the thinking there? I mean, it just really doesn't make sense.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you have to think of the text and the environment, the social environment in which it emerged. Certainly, patriarchy was the way, we can say that it still is, but definitely a strongly patriarchal society. And so the stories that we get out of the Bible are are telling us about what a proper life should be, and it's basically written for men. And so we are understanding then that a woman's place should be submissive and to lean to her husband or lean to her father, and so she's not to really step outside of that. And oh, go ahead.
Well, I was just about to say, I just wish I could have been a fly on the wall back then and see how that really went over with all the women. If they, if you know, they just sort of rolled over and said, "Yes, master," or if you know, they put up a fight, but you know, it just didn't do any good because you know, it was the men who made the dogma and the men who wrote the book, and you know, and we know what all happened after that.
Exactly. Exactly. I believe, you know, I have this belief that, you know, people who are oppressed, and we can see this in a number of communities where people are oppressed, there's subversive ways of speaking back to oppressive power. Even if you can't just directly say, you know, no, I won't go for that, or, you know, picket or something like that, there are things that you can do as a person who doesn't theoretically have power that still gets your point across. So I'm sure that many of those women were doing things, in fact, to let their dissatisfaction be known, but their context was limited.
Well, and if I seem to remember way back in my memory somewhere that there was also a second version of Genesis that actually had man and woman created simultaneously. Certainly, the woman wasn't made from the man. And in that in itself, if that book had been chosen for the Bible, I mean, I know it didn't serve the patriarch's agenda to put the male above the female, but had, you know, there been a voice of reason that wasn't trying to set one gender above the other, that would have probably been the proper book to choose, because then you'd have had men and women in equality. I mean, is that just a myth, or do you know if that's true? Was there another version of Genesis?
Well, there's actually, within the version of Genesis that most of us have in the Bible, there's two creation stories, or there's two versions of the story. And what we miss in the English is that we don't understand that Adam actually means human being.
And, so it wasn't necessarily a male? Is that what you mean?
Exactly, exactly. Okay. So we have personified the name Adam to be a man, a male person, whereas in Hebrew, Adama really means the human one, kind of even a reference to human being of the soil, like earthling.
Mm-hmm.
And so a being that's human, but not necessarily male, but you see how the patriarchal overlay says, okay, well, that must have been a man.
Because yeah, it was in the interpretation.
Exactly. So you see the interpretive layers start to happen on top of, you know, certain ideals or scripture. So, yeah, there's two stories like right there within Genesis that tell us that, you know, was this really a man, a male person? And does this really happen this way where God put him to sleep and then withdrew a rib from him? I mean, really?
Well, and you know what? I have to tell you, when you use the word earthling, my mind thought, okay, people who are, you know, UFO folks are going to love that. You know, they're going to just take that and run with that. But also, too, I'm thinking, you know, this isn't the only time that things have been interpreted in, you know, into the advantage of the male. I mean, look at Father, Son, Holy Spirit.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we know Holy Spirit was either gender neutral or female till it was translated and turned into male. I mean, we can prove that today.
Mm-hmm.
So it's not like, you know, I mean, this was happening all the time, I would imagine.
Yeah, it was happening all of the time. I mean, there's research that's been done, and there's a book called When God Was a Woman. But even if you don't have, you know, that particular book, you can look back in history and find that there were times when women were leading in certain types of religions. And so what happened to change that from these nature religions whereby women were the ones who were leaders to male-dominated religions where God becomes a warrior, a conqueror, a king? All of this male sort of conquering language began to be equated with the gods.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And then ultimately, you know, one God in Yahweh. But, and so then at the same time, then, okay, the feminine who is associated with the earth and fertility and nurturing, that has to be, you know, marginalized or subjugated underneath the conquering male god.
Because heaven forbid if the two set side by side, I mean, if somebody just didn't get it, that maybe they would just be wonderful compliments for one another. You know, it's just the balance that there would be. I mean, I think of the ancient Egyptians who were all about, you know, thwarting chaos and trying to keep things in balance, you know. But that book you mentioned, When God Was a Woman, that's by Merlin Stone. And a great book for any of our listeners who might not know about it. And I have to say, quite frankly, that book and Rhian Eisler's Chalice and the Blade many, many years ago are what got me going in this direction. And just awesome books. Great book reference. Thank you for that, Dr. Martin. But let's talk about some of these women from the past, Lilith, Eve, Mary Magdalene, Mary of Nazareth. I mean, they were powerful biblical women, I would imagine. I mean, I like to think that probably Jesus learned social justice from the knee of his mother, you know, under the yoke of the Romans. You know, I can't imagine that he didn't get something from her. You know, tell us about some of these women and, you know, and why don't we, I don't know, elevate them maybe more than we do.
Well, first I'd just like to pick up on what you said about balance and how, you know, in the Eastern traditions there is more of a balance about, you know, yin and yang and male and female and a god and his consort. You know, we get a lot of that in those traditions. And so what we're finding in the West is that our religions tend to be lopsided, you know, male dominant and lopsided. And like you said, it doesn't need to be dominant. You know,
right.
To have the partnership and the balance is actually the healthier way. And Carl Jung, the psychologist, points out, depth psychologist, points out that Catholicism actually has picked up on the importance of the feminine energy and the way that they have injected Mary into the almost elevated to the Trinity. You know, you've got Father, Son, Holy Spirit, and then you've got, you know, Mariology, which is, you know, a doctrine within the Catholic Church. And it says that, okay, we're going to lift Mary up to be, you know, almost a status of her own, you know, like the Mary, the mother of God. She has a high status. And so Carl Jung said, you know, within Catholicism, she's almost a fourth part, and that her presence as feminine energy is really necessary to human balance, to our own psyche. It's absolutely necessary. So he says, you know, the Protestants who don't have Mary as being such an important figure are out of balance. And he saw so much dysfunction based in a religion that was just at its foundation out of balance. And
okay.
So, anyway, I can go on and talk about the other women that you mentioned.
Well, no. Well, I mean, I think this is so important because, quite frankly, when I'm out there talking about this to groups, you know, this idea of balance, I try to stress right at the top of the discussion because, you know, so many men have the idea that because we want to try to interject a goddess, a female face of God, or even just her ideals or her archetype into the picture, that somehow this is about women ruling the world and subjugating men. And, you know, look, I'm not saying there aren't fundamentalists in, you know, even within goddess spirituality. I know they exist. But, you know, that's not really the thrust of what this is about. And it's not certainly, you know, the majority. You know, most people who are looking at goddess spirituality today are looking for balance, for wholeness for women and men, you know, as they embrace that divine masculine and sacred feminine within themselves and try to, you know, create it in the outside world as well. Because, you know, as individuals, we're out of balance. As a world, we're out of balance.
Exactly. And so right now, even there are, you know, spiritual leaders who say, given the situation that we have in our world right now, we are desperate for the feminine energy to come back because we've been male-dominant energy for so long that we're just clearly out of balance. And it's nothing. There's nothing wrong with male energy. I don't want men who may be listening to say, oh, this is going to be a male-bashing thing. And
no, it's not that, no.
It's not that at all. It's to say that, you know, we are equal beings, equal earthlings, if you will, and that in order for us to really progress as human beings, we have to get that together. We have to get that right. We can't be lopsided and expect to have, you know, a perfectly just society that works for everyone. We've got to get over our oppressive structures and make it a balancing. So men who might fear that, okay, I'm going to lose something. No, it's not that you're going to lose something. We all gain.
Well, and also, too, I would think that, you know, a guy, you know, the average guy, wouldn't he want a helpful partner that's going to pull her own weight? And, I mean, I think, you know, I think about this as, you know, in terms of like a good marriage, when you got, you know, you got a guy and a gal who, you know, work well together and they're good partners. I mean, it's sort of the same analogy, you know. They're so much more successful when, you know, the two complement each other. And I don't know, I think that's, you know, another way of looking at what we're talking about.
Right. It's a great word to use, the complement, the complementarity of the relationship, and how much smoother things go when we complement as opposed to oppose or dominate. I mean, if anything, we should learn from world history is that, you know, domination isn't really the way to go. Ultimately, domination inspires rebellion.
Yes,
and
yes.
The people who are oppressed or marginalized will ultimately cause some sort of upheaval to the social structure. And so rather than saying, okay, well, I'm going to hold on to my position of power until such time happens, why can't we, you know, restructure things in a way that works for people before we get to a crisis point?
Well, when you think about it, these people who have this need to dominate and control, it almost, I mean, I'm not a psychologist, but it seems to me they're really coming from a place of fear.
Right.
Because, you know, because they got to keep their thumb on somebody rather than, you know, trust that they're going to be able to collaborate and negotiate and, you know?
Oh, yeah. I think we see that in so many ways that, you know, the fear. Fear is a powerful element over the human being, and so when people have something, the thought of losing it or the thought of the unknown is what can really undo a person, right? It's like, well, I guess I better hold on to what I have because I don't know what life will be like without it, and I certainly don't want to be under your thumb.
Right, right.
So it's like, I'll keep control because I don't want you to control me.
Right. Well, and you think about it, too. I mean, look at the uproar when feminism really first hit the stage.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the spin doctors were saying feminism was going to unravel the fabric of society.
Mm-hmm.
Well, let's you know, sort of define what they said. They said if women are equal, if we give women equality, it will unravel the fabric of society. I mean, to me, that's mind-boggling that society swallowed that.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and, well, that just goes back to one of my pet peeves, that we really do have to rehabilitate the idea in the name feminism, you know, because it just means trying to level the playing field, having a caring culture, and what the heck is wrong with that?
Right. It sounds like a scary word. And, you know, since I teach at a university, there are young women who are, you know, coming into their own and coming to the knowledge about what it is to be an oppressed person versus a free person and saying, okay, well, I'm a woman and there are these things that exist out there that could theoretically, you know, oppress me or keep me from being my fullest self. So sometimes I see young women on campus, they have T-shirts that says, this is what a feminist looks like. Because and a couple men wear them as well.
Good for them.
I know, right? It's very, you know, encouraging to see some young men do that as well, because I think there was this image about what a feminist was, such a became, you know, this derogatory term, a dirty
yeah.
word, that they're trying to undo the fabric of America, trying to, you know, take the place of men or usurp power from men. And, you know, as you've been saying, it's not about that. It's really about balancing out our world so that it really works better. And so when I see these young women, I'm happy about it because it's like, yes, they're becoming aware, they're waking up,
yes.
to you know what has maybe been told to them in their lives or what they've been reading about, you know, the world up to now, and now they're stepping out and saying, you know what, that's not actually the full story.
Well, and I'm thinking too, I hear so much, and I hope, you know, I hope this is skewed. I hear so much that young women today really don't like the idea of feminism, that they really don't want equality. If you're on a college campus, are you finding that attitude as the minority or the majority, or can you, you know, from an anecdotal perspective, can you speak to that?
Oh, I don't find at all that women are saying that they...
Oh, good. Okay.
In fact,
maybe it's because we're in a blue state, though.
I was just going to say that maybe because, you know, we're in Southern California, we're in a blue state, and it's safer or an easier position to take than maybe if you lived in Texas. And if you're a young person just trying to find your way, you know, you might fall back upon these religious teachings or family teachings. And here it seems to be a more open environment where, I've never heard a student say that, you know, a woman say, well, you know, maybe this is too much, or maybe we don't need all of that. Even though there are some conservative people at the school, I mean, I teach religion, I teach history, and on occasion I run into people who are really entrenched into the conservative pieces of their religion, but typically not on this issue.
Good, good. Well, that's good to know. And I do want to mention we're starting to get some callers, and if folks can be patient with us, I want to get a little bit more into the conversation, and we will get to you before the end of the interview with Dr. Martin. But Dr. Martin, we were about to start talking about some of the powerful women from history. Were there any in particular you wanted to, you know, highlight tonight or highlight their story? Or maybe we don't really know their story. It's been, you know, swept under the rug or...
Yeah, so we mentioned Eve already.
Yeah.
But, what a lot of people don't realize is there's a story about Adam having a first wife. And no, this is not biblical. As one might imagine, it would certainly not be considered appropriate. But it is in Jewish literature that there was a woman named Lilith who was Adam's first wife, and that she left Adam because he was oppressive to her. And there's a language that says that suggests that what Adam was trying to dominate her sexually is the connotation. And Lilith said, you know what, we are created equal by God, and I will not tolerate this. And she left.
Yay, Lilith.
But what has happened to that story, as I said, it's not, you know, canonical. It's not what you're going to find in anybody's Bible. And what happened to her, she was really demonized. She was marginalized. And her story became one of, or her identity became one that said, what you told your children, okay, if you're not a good little girl, a good little boy, Lilith will get you. She was turned into a witch, into a demonic figure that was evil, someone who upset the social order.
In some of the stories, wasn't she even a succubus that would suck the life out of you when you slept and all of that stuff?
Exactly. So all of these, she turned into a position from a position of being a powerful woman standing up for herself into someone who was demonic and evil, someone who would suck the life out of you, someone who would trick you, don't trust her. And so in the Jewish tradition now, the literature is like that. And so when I share this with my students, they're like, I never even heard of this. Well, no.
Right. Well, and that's the patriarchy strategy, right? I mean, to take power away from that which is their, I guess, adversary, or, you know, not toeing their party line kind of
right.
a thing.
Right, to do that. And if you can't entirely remove the person or the idea, then disparage it, demonize it, so that people don't even look to it anymore, and that over the centuries people have forgotten her.
Well, it also reminds me of what's happened with our menstrual blood. I know Barbara Walker and a lot of other people write about how, you know, it was a substance that was revered and thought to have all of these powers of immortality and, well, certainly life-giving fluid. And it sort of seems like, you know, what they couldn't create themselves, what they couldn't control, then they demonized. And now look where we are with, it's the curse, you know.
Right.
You know, women have this negative attitude about their menses when it used to be a powerful time for women.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's two great books that come to mind. One is by an anthropologist, Mary Douglas, Purity and Danger.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know that one? And
no, I don't know that one. I'll write that down.
Yeah, Mary Douglas, Purity and Danger. And she writes about the ways in which you know, there are these ideas about what is pure and what is unclean, what's clean and what is unclean. And so, as you were just saying, like a woman's menstrual blood is considered very powerful, but because it's uncontrollable from the male point of view, it's unclean.
Right. And I mean, there, it, you know, certain cultures have gone so far as to say if a menstruating woman walks on an agricultural field, the crops will all die.
Right.
You know, there are cultures where women are actually put in these, well, for lack of a better word, I don't really know what they call them, but sort of these cages suspended so that their feet don't touch the ground when they're, you know, on their menses. I mean, crazy stuff.
Wow. Yeah, it really is, because you can see right there that there's a certain power or mystery, maybe is a better word, mystery associated with femininity. And so if it's unknown, uncontrollable, then men felt the desire or felt the need to control in some way. And so, okay, I'll just declare you unclean, therefore I can limit your mobility by making you have to go over there when that happens.
Mm-hmm.
Don't prepare food. Don't touch anything. So the second book I was going to recommend is called The Red Tent, which is a work of fiction by Anita Diamant, but it takes over a biblical story about Dinah and retells the story from her point of view.
Great book, yeah.
Great book, and it's about, you know, how women come together and literally bleed together.
Yes, yes.
In the tent where women are, you know, supposed to go during that time of the month.
And the men are cooking the meals and taking care of themselves after that week.
Yes, it's a wonderful book if people are interested. A wonderful book, but...
Well, you know, this sort of leads us into what you can't control, and that sort of, you know, feels like this is a great segue to sexuality, because, I mean, you look at, and honestly, I may be misspeaking here, and if I am, I give you absolute permission to correct me, but you look at what Muslim women, I think, must endure, having to wear this burqa, and, you know, they have to totally shroud themselves so that you can barely even see their eyes. To me, that suggests that the power of a woman's sexuality, the power of her body, is so intimidating, so fearful, that they control it by hiding it. They, you know, they can't. Men can't control their own emotions, their own, their own problem, I guess, you know, you could say, and so they make it the woman's problem. You know, she's the one that has to suffer.
Mm-hmm. Well, I do know, of some Muslim women who say that they consider wearing it, covering, a sign of submission to God, and so it really is a matter of her relationship with God. So some women cover, or they cover, you know, just their hair, and that says something about her relationship with God, aside from, you know, what a man might say. But yeah, the women who are completely covered and all you can see are their eyes, I mean, that really, certainly to our Western eyes, looks oppressive. And then the underlying point that you bring out is like, okay, well, who's really having the issue? Is it the woman or the man about the woman's ability to seduce or somehow lead astray? And so if we cover her, then a man can, what, focus on his life or something.
Well,
and
look, in the mosque, the men and women can't pray together. The women have to be in the back where the men aren't distracted.
And you know what? A student of mine raised this yesterday, I think it was. We had a discussion about a young woman who was wearing a revealing outfit, very short shorts and a low-cut tank top. And I was sharing with the class that I wanted her to know how she would be perceived. And so I took it upon myself to say to her, you know, can you, you know, come here for a second? She was a student of mine. And I said, you know, you're perfectly free to wear what you want. I just want you to know what might be some potential consequences. Are you aware that people will look at you this way?
Mm-hmm.
And she just kind of got really quiet, and so I was telling that story. And so another student yesterday said, but by saying that a woman can't wear this or that, isn't it really a man's issue? Then we keep avoiding the male issue by continuing to tell women what they have to wear.
Right. Well, I mean, and that sort of ties into the contemporary idea of beauty. I mean, who's telling us what beauty is today? I mean, you have women going to plastic surgeons in droves with food, you know, eating disorders to, you know, live up to this patriarchal ideal of beauty. And I don't know, that feels like that's a man's issue, too, that women have just made their own.
Yeah, we really have internalized a lot. I mean, you know, we've bought into, and this is what I, you know, I get into with women that I work with in terms of giving away power. We've really bought into this notion that we have to look a certain way, we have to be a certain way, we have to do a certain thing in order to be considered desirable. But even on that track, once we start down that road, if we go too far, according to, you know, whomever, if we go too far, then we're in the land of being considered loose and promiscuous.
But it's okay for men, though, double standard, you know.
Oh, there's a double standard, exactly. And so, you know, even these other biblical figures like Mary Magdalene or Jezebel, Mary Magdalene is presented to us or taught to us as if she's a prostitute.
Right.
But,
and look how quietly the church decided that was an error. I mean, it's not like they announced it from the rooftops with fanfare. It was just they sort of quietly decided, well, no, we made a mistake. She really wasn't a prostitute.
And it comes out of a society, the ancient society in which the text was written, that there should not be single women of their own agency. Every woman should be either in her father's house or married. Under
right.
the auspices of a male. And so if you have a single woman who seems to be, you know, handling her own show, so to speak, then something is wrong with her. She's a woman out of place. She's a woman that can be a threat to the social order.
Mm-hmm.
And because of that, she was, we could say, demonized and called a prostitute, labeled a prostitute for centuries.
Or you think about Jezebel. You know, she was one of the powerful women. And look, that's a term we use now for a loose woman.
Exactly. It's synonymous with promiscuity. We can just say, oh, she's a Jezebel, and then everyone knows, oh, okay. But Jezebel's crime was that she was true to her religion. That's really her only crime, and she was perceived as being, well, she, you know, she practiced a Canaanite religion, or I'm sorry, a Phoenician religion, and that looked polytheistic to the followers of Yahweh, the Hebrew people. So they said, okay, well, she is serving many male gods. She is promiscuous in her faith. And so what we've taken from that is that, okay, she's promiscuous. She must have been sleeping around with many men. Even in the text, there's no reference to her being unfaithful to her
husband.
She was
just a polytheist.
She was a polytheist.
I didn't know that.
And she was married to a Jewish king, and she did not give up her own religion.
She was a priestess.
She was a priestess, exactly. So by her remaining faithful to her own faith, she was considered, okay, now she's going to lead poor King Ahab astray. And, you know, so you can see the layers once again getting built up around Jezebel and she being demonized as a promiscuous woman. And then how many women since her up to the current day where we say, oh, a promiscuous woman is a Jezebel.
Well, why do we do this as women? I mean, you know, the topic of the show is casting our pearls before swine. That's obviously, you know, an analogy for giving up our power, for, you know, not valuing ourselves. Is it this patriarchal culture that has marginalized us for so long that, you know, makes us not realize the power of our sexuality or that we should revere it and, you know, not give it away so cheaply?
Oh, absolutely. We've as you keep saying, drank the Kool-Aid. We've internalized this sort of oppression, and it is fed to us in so many ways. It's very insidious. And even if we look at our popular culture, again, what do little girls grow up looking at? In terms of like how should I look as a woman? And so what they see music videos, they see movies where, you know, women are coming out of their tops. They see these hypersexualized images of the female. And so every little girl then receives that information, and either she has somebody to help her edit it or she doesn't, and then she emulates it.
Well, I got a flash of that little girl Joan Benet Ramsey, you know, in these beauty contests, you know, where these little girls are you know, made to look like grown women.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I know that's, you know, sort of, you know, peripheral, but sorry, I didn't mean to interrupt you there. But or you think about, you know, women who feel like they, you know, they have to be so thin, you know, to be able to, you know, runway thin.
Right.
And, you know, and if they're not, somehow they, you know, they don't. Exactly.
Yeah, and to hear young girls talking about being sexy, I mean, young girls like what we call tweens,
right?
They say, "Well, I want to look sexy, so I want to wear a cropped, top." And you know, when I was in school, I remember we used to have when it would get warm, we would have the principal tell us, you know, over the announcements every day, you know, the bottom of your top has to reach the top of your bottom. There's to be no midriff showing. There's to be no navel showing. But young girls grow up thinking, well, that's what I should look like. That's what I'm supposed to look like. Why am I supposed to look like that? Because the guys like it. So
mm-hmm.
What is it? So then, okay, you're giving away something of yourself, even if it's just a peek at your belly, because you think that a man likes it. Not even because necessarily you like it yourself, but you think, okay, this is how I am attractive. And if I don't do it, the other girl next to me who does do it, she's going to get all the male attention.
Well, and then right there is also part of the programming that, you know, some of the most important things to young women or women in general, not just young women, is are they going to land a guy?
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's like, you know, that they judge themselves, their value on if they have a partner.
Right.
Or young women will, you know, go to college to get a husband. I mean, I don't think that's changed a whole lot, has it?
Well, I don't hear women talking about they've gone to college to get a husband, but it's so indoctrinated in us that you should get married, you need a husband, and if you're 30 and don't have one, something is wrong. And, you know, I work with women. I counsel women who are having real anxiety as they approach 35 and they don't have a husband. They start to internalize this thing that says something must be wrong with me. And instead of just saying, well, I haven't met that person yet, or, you know, whatever the situation might be, it becomes, okay, well, what's wrong with me? And in that anxiety then starts to act out. So when I say casting pearls before swine, and I don't mean to call men swine, so I don't want people to think that. It's an expression, and it means that you're giving something of value where it's not fully appreciated.
Yes.
And you're doing it in an anxious state in order to get something that you want.
It's like desperation.
It's out of a desperate place. So women who are then sleeping around because they hope the guy will marry them, that is a totally disempowering action that, you know, in this day and age doesn't work, if it ever did.
Well, you know, and it makes me think about how some people say, you know what, they found Mr. Right when they stopped looking. You know, it's like,
yeah,
when they dropped maybe that anxiousness or that desperation,
right,
and they were just being themselves.
Right. Stopped thinking so much and projecting so much outside, but taking care of the inside, taking care of your pearls and valuing yourself so that you naturally attract. In my work, I really talk a lot about naturally attracting. I don't say you need to do this, 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 and this so that you can go out and get a man. It's
right.
Like, no, I'm trying to encourage in women, find out what it is within you that is great, uncover that, dust that off, shine up those pearls, and then when that's clear, you will have men naturally attractive to you. Because
you're going to be projecting a totally different aura.
Exactly. Confidence and inner beauty and inner glow. They won't even know necessarily why. Oh, my gosh, I just have to be around her.
Well, now, Dr. Martin, tell some examples, if you have some handy at the front of your mind. How can women recognize when they're maybe fallen prey to this behavior, you know? Are there some examples of how we give away our power that maybe we'll recognize in our, you know, in our sisters or our you know, women friends or?
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely. So, I mean, I guess the premier one is in relationships where women are involved with men they really don't like. Women who stay with a man because they don't feel they can either do any better or they don't feel like they can provide for themselves, so they stay with men for money. Totally disempowering. because no matter how great the guy may seem to others, you're living with someone who doesn't fully value you. You're not valuing yourself, so of course he doesn't really value you. So women who are staying in relationships that don't honor them, women who are playing down who they fully are. So I work with women who are typically what we might call very successful, you know, out in the world very successful, and but they're having some relationship issue. They don't have a man in their lives, or they keep having the same patterns, and so they turn what I call turn down their light. They minimize their accomplishments. They minimize what it is they have to offer out of fear that if a man saw who they were fully, the man would be intimidated and leave.
So that sort of plays into, you know, sometimes young girls are told, don't look too smart.
Exactly. Don't raise your hand in class all the time. Let the boys answer.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's not considered as attractive. So, I mean, really think of the disservice we do to our girls as children, and then somehow we expect them to, what, get it together or figure it out or fix it when they're adults. Which means, what, going to therapy or something.
And we have all this baggage.
We have all of this baggage, exactly. And then, well, you know, then they come to see me and say, you know, why do I have these recurrent problems? And, you know, so I help them, you know, one client, she knew, she recognized. She said, well, any time that I was the smartest, you know, men have told me, well, I didn't want to, if I had known you had a PhD, I don't know if I'd ever have spoken to you.
Mm.
You know, and so she got into the habit of minimizing herself. And I said to her, you know what, when you go out into the world doing what you do, you're going to let your light shine. You're going to be bright because the men who can't stand the light, the moths who get burned by the flame, you don't, that's not your guy.
Right.
So there's another guy in the room who sees, like, wow, what's that glowing over there?
Mm-hmm.
I want to go see what that is. But I recognize that for so many women, they're getting through, they've got to work through that internal stuff, the baggage that will even allow them to turn up their light. Because they hear the words when I say them, but they go, oh, I don't know if I can really do that, though.
Or they fall into back into patterns when they're actually out there in the world.
Exactly, because it seems safer. Maybe their friends are in the habit of doing it, and they, you know, so then they get the backlash from their own friends, their own female friends, and say, well, who do you think you are? Or, oh, wow, look at you.
Right, right.
So it's kind of a new path that a woman might have to venture down and say to herself, no, I'm going to own myself. I'm going to value myself. I'm going to think of myself as a pearl, something of value. And I'm going to, you know, if it's about a relationship, I'm going to look for men who also value me on that level.
Well, and women might also be working against programming of their own mother. I mean, I'm thinking in terms of women from, you know, an earlier generation who were brought up with these ideas too. You know, they may have to, shirk off, you know, either the conscious or unconscious messages their own mother gave them.
Exactly. And my client I was just referring to, she is, I kept saying, you know, you're so courageous and you're so on the right path of doing this. And I recognize, you know, I just want to acknowledge, because you do have to shake off the old stuff. And you really are going down a new path, or at least a new path for you, when you decide that you're not going to any longer go along with the status quo. You're not going to, oh, here's another way, you know, women who compete for a man, who fight over a man, who, you know, want to fight another woman. And I share this with my young women, my students. Please don't get into a fight with a woman over a man.
Or don't you love it when there's this love triangle, okay? Mm-hmm. And the man is the dog, you know, cheating on both women, and the women get mad at each other
instead
of the guy.
That's what I'm talking about. Like, don't fight with each other, because if he is your husband or your boyfriend, he's the one who has a responsibility toward you, not her.
Right.
And even though if she knows, it's a better idea for her not to get involved, but let's just say, you know, she knows or she doesn't know. Even if you fight with her, do you think that's going to end your problem with your man?
No, it's just going to temporarily put it off till the next one comes along.
So how many women are you willing to fight in your life in order to keep this one man?
Yeah, I mean, it's just too much work. I mean, that's a big red flag that this is not the one.
And I mean, so for women who are going through your partner's pockets or going through his cell phone, you're checking his email, stop it.
Well, you know, and I don't, you know, maybe this is peripheral, but let me just mention it in terms of women competing. I'd like to say that it's not just about men. I think women should learn to support one another more, you know, whether, it, you know, in the community, in the workplace, mm-hmm. you know, because there is that, I mean, look, there's nothing wrong with healthy competition. I'm not saying that. But so often women, you know, get this green-eyed monster, you know, like maybe their friend published a book or something. You know, they've done something that they feel they haven't done, you know, and they measure themselves against their friend. And all of a sudden, you know, it ruins the friendship, you know, instead of supporting one another. It just feels like, it, you know, women, we're the majority out there. And if we didn't work against each other, what a force we could be.
I know, but that gets to low self-esteem when, you know, you're comparing and competing with someone else and saying, okay, well, I'm going to somehow sabotage that person. I mean, if it gets to that level, really, we're just diminishing ourselves, diminishing our power collectively as women. That you just pointed out, we have a majority, but we're the ones diminishing our own power.
Yeah, I think statistics show less than 20% women are represented less than 20% in academia, political life, and corporate America. Mm-hmm. You know, so you know, we need to be better represented.
Oh, well, yeah. And then if we could just speak to about, you know, the power of sexuality and how women, you know, throw their pearls before swine. I mean, that's very clear of really the sleeping with a man to get him, to get his attention, to get him to love you, to get him to marry you. I mean, those days, it doesn't work.
It doesn't last. You know, it might just be for, you know, a quick, you know, a short period of time, but it's not thinking long term, I don't think.
Exactly, and that's what I mean by it doesn't last. Either you wake up the next day with heartache because he already left, or you get into a situation where, you know, you're pregnant, you're bringing a child into the world with a man who doesn't want to be with you, and you thought that the child was going to make the difference.
Yeah, and they never do.
And it doesn't make the difference. Even if, let's say he marries the woman, marries you, it's not the fully loving relationship that you could potentially have because the circumstances by which the marriage came apart are really not completely honest.
Right. And that's really important. You know, we you know, it's sort of that concept of the bird in the hand. You know, you're grasping at what's in front of you right now because you're so afraid there might be another opportunity down the road, and you settle.
Right.
And, you know, you settle for something that maybe is not worthy of you.
So afraid. And I did a teleseminar about the art of sexual healing, and I talk about the Song of Solomon and the Kama Sutra and Tantra as sort of the backdrop to what I was really getting about women's power of sexuality, but how we have internalized this message that something is wrong with our sexuality. But here I went to these spiritual texts and said, here are the ways in which sexuality has actually been celebrated and uplifted. So you don't have to drink the Kool-Aid that tells you that your sexuality is bad, but for your own sake, value yourself, value your own sexuality, value the act itself, because there's power in it, power for you, pleasure in it, and there's nothing wrong with that. But if you abuse it, you're destined for heartache.
Well, Dr. Martin, time is flying on us here, and we have a caller we have to get to. But just before we get to our caller, I just want to make sure before we run out of time, you've been giving us all sorts of pearls of wisdom. Are there any important ideas that you want to make sure you leave listeners with that maybe we haven't covered? And do you have a website?
Yeah. So this the Art of Sexuality is the program I was just referring to, and that can be found at my website, drdarnese.com/product. It's a download, and it's also a CD if anyone wants to hear that Art of Sexual Healing. My main website is drdarnesemartin.com. That's drdarnesemartin.com, and it's spelled with Darnese is spelled with an S. What else would I refer to? I have a free offer for your listeners if you want to get this special report at drdarnice.com. A little bit different from the other one, drdarnice.com. It's a report, 75 Love Tips for a Great Relationship at Any Stage. And so that's freely available. Just go to that site and you can pick that up.
Okay.
I would like to leave people with the idea that, you know, sexuality is good. I know we've all inherited ideas that say that it's not, or that it has to be, there's so many rules or prescriptions about it or around
it. Or shameful.
Shameful, but that you can actually enjoy it. But what's critical is, like, loving yourself, and that the female energy, the female body is a powerful and beautiful thing. And how profound is it to say that or to own that? But I think to how sad it is that we have to continually almost do an intentional sort of reprogramming of not only girls and women, but men too.
It doesn't come naturally to us.
It doesn't come naturally to us. And so in a way it's very sad, but, you know, there are tools out there where we can do that. We can reclaim our own value. We can love ourselves. We can own our own sexuality. We can take pleasure in it without feeling abused, without having heartache. We can cast our pearls. We can own ourselves as pearls. We can cast our pearls before someone who values us and loves us.
And make us a queen.
And make us a queen, like Queen Esther in the Bible, you know, like find some aspect of yourself that you can really glorify and love, right? So, you know, that's what's in that program, The Art of Sexuality. And that's really what my work is about in terms of working with women, is to really uplift who you are already, and then you'll naturally attract love.
Mm.
Don't go out beating the bushes trying to find it, because that's just desperation and fear.
Right, right. Well, you're doing good work. Thank you. Because we women, like we said, we carry a lot of baggage. Sometimes we need a lot of help or just, you know, some sisterly reminding. Well, let me see if our caller here is, because sometimes our callers don't actually like to talk. So let me see if this one would like to talk. So I'm going to try to unmute the caller. Caller, are you there? Hello, caller? Woohoo. You're in a 310 area code, caller. You can talk now if you'd like. Okay, well, maybe they're shy.
Ah!
I don't know. They've been patiently waiting the entire time, and now, you know, when given the chance, let me try one more time here. Are you there, caller?
Are you there?
Hello?
Hello?
I'm just getting feedback.
I hear someone.
I think that was me. Let me see. Let me try one more time. Hello?
Hello?
You know,
hello?
I don't know whether it's someone playing games with me or or they really have a question. If you have a question, please feel free to ask Dr. Martin.
Are you hearing me? Can you hear me when I'm
speaking? Oh, yes, we can hear you. I'm sorry. Yeah, please, go ahead. We were trying to connect with you. Bizarre, isn't it?
Well, it was because I was listening. I have just loved this conversation. My name is Cherry Norris. I am known as the
Cherry.
Hollywood Dating Director, and Darnice sent me an email, and I just thought, ooh, I want to hear what she has to say. And I have absolutely loved this.
Hi, Cherry.
I loved it. How are you? I was like, I've got to call her as soon as I get off the phone. And then I heard you say there's a caller in the 310, and I was like, well, are they talking about me? Maybe they can see my line. And so I thought, well, if they are, I'll say hello. But I wasn't calling in to ask a question, but I'm really happy to speak with you.
Oh, okay. Well, I'm so glad that you called in, and I appreciate your support. And go to drdarnice.com and see your free gift.
I will. I'm not kidding, Darnice. I want to know more. This is excellent. It's really, really good what you're
doing. I just met Shelby last week, so I really appreciate her being here.
Yeah, well, these kids are so lucky to have you. I mean, I'm like thinking, you know, you're teaching college. They are so lucky to have you.
Well, thank you.
Oh, if I were that age, I would want to hear what you have to say. And I just applaud your saying that that generation has to really be courageous and someone has to really start paving the way. And my feeling is you're paving the way for them to do that.
Well, thank you. You know, I do get positive feedback from, you know, I mean, there's like the core content of what I teach, but I also add in these things called life lessons. Mm-hmm. And it's that kind of thing. It's like talking to young women about, you know, don't do things for the male gaze because you think men will think it's hot. Stop doing that.
Yeah.
And they tell me later, oh, I so appreciated you saying that.
Well, valuing themselves and their sexuality and their sensuality and just taking that power and putting it in a different direction, you know, is just fantastic. I mean, that's so along the lines of what I'm doing as well, and it's so fantastic you're going to that audience.
Oh, yeah, and Cherry's a great relationship person as well. So.
Well, Cherry, thank you so much for calling in.
Well, you're welcome. It was great speaking with you all. Carry on. It was a great interview.
All right. Thank you so much. And
okay.
send your other clients to Voices of the Sacred Feminine. We always have topics like this. And we're actually getting ready to start a Four Mothers and Wayshower series that's going to run from the rest of October through January. And it's going to be, you know, all of these, you know, women who have paved the way, as you said, you know, for us to be doing what we're doing right now.
I love it. I'm on the path. Okay.
Well, goodbye, and thank you for calling in. Please call again.
Have a great evening.
All right, bye-bye.
Thank you.
Well, Dr. Martin, anything else before we call it a night?
Let's see what else I would say. Just reminding people, 75 Love Tips for a Great Relationship at Any Stage is a free report on drdarnese.com.
Okay.
And they can just find out about the other work that I do and how I help women, how I help, you know, girls develop and hopefully avoid some of these pitfalls.
Because, you know, the reality is women or young women, young girls, they're not always getting this at home because, you know, maybe their moms don't even know.
Right, and that's why I said something to the young woman who was dressed, you know, in sort of skimpy clothes. I thought, you know, I don't know what she has going on in her home life. So if no one has said anything to her, let me be the one to say something because I've had my feelings hurt as
mm-hmm.
a young woman and, you know, not so young woman, of making a mistake by just being naive.
Yes.
And not knowing that I was going to get a certain reaction. And, you know, I mean, if I just saw in her, listen, I can make a difference. Her mother's not here, even if her mother has been helpful all along. She's away from home right now in college. I'm going to extend myself. She may even get mad at me for saying, you know, what difference does it make to you kind of a thing. But I just thought that I would do that because I would want someone to do that for my daughter. I would want someone to pull me aside and say, hey, let me tell you what the situation is here. You know, and that's a way that we as women can help one another, right? Help to empower each other.
Absolutely.
Instead of, like, you know, waiting for the other woman to fail. It's like, let me clue you into the environment here before you make a mistake.
Right, right. And because, you know, it's sort of like you get what you give. So if you're putting out this, you know, this sexual vibe, this, excuse the expression, but the Jezebel vibe, mm-hmm. you know, you're maybe not going to get, you know, folks to take you seriously or, you know, you're not going to attract to yourself the quality relationship you want. You know, you're going to end up with the one-night stands or just the one-night hookups, I guess they call
it
today.
Yes, they call them a hookup, exactly. And then that's one of the patterns that shows up in my relationship work. And they say, why am I having this? And I go, because of that.
Yes.
You're putting something else out there, and maybe you're unaware, maybe you're unconscious about how it's coming back at you.
Well, you know, if they, you know, our culture, our Hollywood. I mean, not that I'm anti-Hollywood, I'm not, but you know, it's made it the norm to put out this sexual vibe, and then we wonder when guys only look at women as sex objects.
Mm-hmm. I know it's really easy to connect those dots, but yet. Young girls are still growing up. Like, you remember, young girls, we get dolls to play with, and we start playing house really early on. So then we get the other message that we need to be really sexual. Okay, so I guess sex is the way I'm going to get a husband. So then we start behaving in a sexual way early on because she's thinking, I'm going to get a husband this way. Meanwhile, boys are taught, well, that's not the girl you marry.
Mm-hmm. You don't bring her home to mama.
Exactly. So she's destined for heartache, and he's still looking for, you know, the good girl to actually take home, even though he's certainly not going to turn down the hookup.
Right, exactly. Well, Dr. Morton, thank you so much. You've been a delight, and I appreciate you adding your voice to the archives of Voices of the Sacred Feminine. You have a lot to offer, and I hope our listeners will take advantage of your free offers and take a look at your websites.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I've enjoyed the conversation.
Okay. All right. Well, I guess we'll call it a night. I'm going to go ahead and take a short music break now and let you listen to the music of Jenna Green, and it's going to be the Bard song. Here we go.
We honor now the Celtic Bard. We offer up our praise. Guardians of our mysteries, keepers of the old days.
Well, this is Karen Tate, and I'm back, and I apologize for that little glitch there. I hope you're still with me. If you're just tuning in, this is Karen Tate, hostess of Voices of the Sacred Feminine, where we discuss Goddess, the Divine Feminine, and the resurging interest in right brain thinking, and the feminine consciousness is also called, whether the great she be deity, archetype, or ideal, and how these new values and benchmarks just might save the world. I'd like to make a few announcements before the end of the show. First of all, thanks go out to the Pagan Pride organizers, Brian, Gina, Linda, and everyone else for a glorious event this past weekend. Thanks for your awesome efforts. You heard me mention in past shows, I'm now the LA Women's and Goddess Spirituality Examiner at examiner.com, so I invite you to please go and check out my articles. You can find them by going to examiner.com. As I mentioned, and soon I'll have a link to that site on my own website. The latest article I did is Healthcare, a Goddess Ideal, and it calls out leaders in our spiritual community to no longer remain mute in this healthcare battle that's unraveling the fabric of our society. Now, if anything's unraveling our society, it's that. Certainly not women have equality. Also coming here in the fall, Voices of the Sacred Feminine is going to be having a Four Mothers and Wayshower series. We have lots of women and some men scheduled that certainly fit the profile. I was inspired to do the series by your emails asking, where are the Four Mothers? And so they've heard you, and they're going to be here on the show. So keep tuning in and hear the voices of these leaders who pave the way for goddess advocates everywhere. You won't be disappointed. We're going to have Jean Shinoda Bolin on, Lane Redmond, Joan Marler, Eleanor Gadden, Carol Christ, Rhian Eisler, Starhawk, Isaac Bonowitz. It's a great list. Then moving on to classes, I'm going to be teaching Cakes for the Queen of Heaven at the Goddess Temple in Orange County starting in January through July. It's an 11-class series. Consider giving it to yourself for a holiday present. If you want to be able to talk about goddess spirituality with better understanding and with more confidence, this is the class. It will be a shortcut. Instead of reading all of those books, you can enjoy a participatory, casual, interactive class. I'll also be giving a talk on November 15th at the Sophia Temple, otherwise called Olander, the home of Carl and Leigh McCloskey, on the topic of the Sacred Feminine for a Sustainable Future. And again, that is November 15th, and that'll be in Malibu. Well, if you like what you've been hearing here on Voices of the Sacred Feminine, please tell your friends to tune in and add us as one of your favorites on Blog Talk. I'd like to leave you with one of my favorite musical pieces here. And let me just go down to it. And it's Spring Love by Jenna Green. Here we go. Enjoy.
The grave.